Welcome to Clearly Quaker, an ongoing series of podcasts by Salem Quarterly Meeting, part of the Religious Society of Friends. Salem Quarterly Meeting is an association of seven Southern New Jersey Quaker meetings within Philadelphia Yearly Meeting. This is a talk given by Reverend Dr. John Norwood on Lenape culture. It was given at the Tricorder Gathering of Friends in 2016 at Camp Okanikan in Medford, New Jersey on October 1st. Reverend John R. Norwood is the principal minister to the Prayer Circle Ministry, member of the Tribal Council and Principal Justice of the Tribal Supreme Court of the Nanticoke Lenni Lenape Tribal Nation. Dr. Norwood is also the pastor of Ujima Village Christian Church in Ewing, New Jersey, which is a non-denominational urban congregation and a member of the World Reformed Fellowship.
I welcome you to Lenape Hocking, the land of the Lenape. The area that you are in is part of my ancient homeland. My family came from this area and down on the other side of the Delaware Bay, the different branches of the family. Nanticoke and Lenape people that did not depart, and there were many that did not, and stayed right here, adapting some of the life ways that would enable them to stay in community, some hiding in plain sight. For many years, we did not identify ourselves because it could lead to persecution. In addition to that, for many years, even discussions of our stories and crafts, our history, was something that was only done behind closed doors, and something that was overheard as you were a child listening to your elders speak. I recall my aunts, who were very much into being the keepers of the tribal legacy within my part of the family, and they would pull me aside when I was too young to really have any great appreciation for it. Would tell me very quietly, looking around, almost as though they were afraid someone would hear about who I was and what that meant. I celebrate the fact that these days my children and my grandchildren don't have to go through that in the same way that I did and those that came before me did, that the tribe has risen like mighty water and is proclaiming not only who we are, but what our legacy is, what our heritage is, and also reminding all of what our inherent rights are. And that's a blessing, because where once we've often felt as though we stood alone in a foreign land that was our ancestral land, now our children are able to declare who they are proudly, stand with their heads held high, and defend not only themselves, but also their ancestors and their culture. And we thank the Creator for that. One of the questions that was brought up was the issue of water. And it's a wonderful thing to start there. For us, the concept of the being the protectors of the land, keepers of the land, which is what those of us that remain were called by those that departed. The keepers of the land also are responsible for the waters and the streams, part of the life, the lifeblood, so to speak, of the land that we stand on. Ancient Lenape, and we continue to tell the story today, although we view it in different terms, viewed the earth as absolutely alive. North America was referred to as Turtle Island, and if you go to many Indian events to these days and you are speaking to people, tribal people from across the country, you will hear the phrase Turtle Island. And what we're talking about is North America. And for the Nanticoke Lenape in particular, the symbol of the box turtle is very special to us. Because according to our ancient traditions, the moral stories handed down, the land actually is on the back of a great turtle. And for our particular tribe, it's a box turtle. The box turtle had mud placed on its back after the brave muskrat dove down into the sea to bring up a little clump in its hand. And that clump was placed on the back of the turtle, as the muskrat actually had sacrificed its own life in order to give a place for the people to live. The Creator took that sacrifice and caused the little clump of mud on the back of that turtle to spread out all over the turtle. And trees grew, plants grew, and the animals made their homes there. And that is where we are today. That is where the people live. And so in a very real way, we are connected to the water and the dirt and the animals that are around us. They are also part of our extended family. And to respect the land is to treat it as though it is alive. I know that that's starting to be kind of a new concept, being popularized, but it's an ancient thought for us, that the land is living, and that we have to treat it as living, and that we have a reciprocal relationship with the land, that when the land, when the water, when the trees, when the animals are hurt, so are we. When their habitat is violated, it will have a ripple effect upon us, and that we have a responsibility to care for the earth under our feet and for the four-legged and the eight-legged and the six-legged and the winged creatures that are all around us, because whatever affects them also affects us. And we were given charge, a special place, to help maintain that balance, to respect, to remind others. That's part of the charge that we try to keep. When I'm able to fellowship with a colleague of mine who is Nanticoke, one of the things that he always includes in his blessing of our food is he takes special time to bless the water, because he is very, very sensitive in continuing an ancient tradition of those water blessings. In modern times, there have been those who are starting to take that a little further, and new tribal songs have been written. One of my colleagues from the Ottawa way out in Michigan was singing a song, and we were actually on the phone together, and he was driving by the lakes, and he put the speakerphone on, and he began to sing as he was driving. He was singing to me on the telephone one of the songs that he had just learned, which was a blessing for the healing of the waters, and how crucial it is that the waters be healed. How many of you remember when it the Lenape, the Delaware was so polluted that they didn't even want you to touch it? You know, I have camped north of here years ago, and to see signs that say, you know, don't eat, if you fish, throw them back, don't eat the fish because of mercury. You know, things that my ancestors never would have even considered. We would go to water daily, sometimes twice a day. Going to water was not only for personal hygiene purposes, but it was also a spiritual thing, to wash, bless yourself with water. Water, the steam was used in our lodges, our sweat lodges. The Lenape lodges are different from those of some other tribes. Our traditional lodges are not meant for suffering and endurance. So they're not quite as hot, but steam is used, the pores are open. Medicine is actually mixed into the water that is poured upon those rocks. Maybe I'm getting ahead of myself. Does anyone know what a sweat lodge is? Okay, well, some do, some don't. A sweat lodge, and many Indian and Native American cultures across North America participate in various types of sweat lodges. But for us, it was a dome of saplings covered with skins, and rocks were superheated outside of it. And it's still the same practice today. The rocks are superheated in a fire, and there in the lodge is a little pit. And you go in and circle the lodge and sit or lay down, whatever I have to lay down. I have a hard time sitting up like that. And the rocks are brought in different rounds, you know, a few at a time. And they are glowing, and they're put in the pit. And then as prayers are offered and songs are sung and testimonies are shared, water is poured over the rocks and steam comes up. Well, there are certain medicine blends that some of our people are familiar with that are traditional, that at various seasons would be put in the water so that as the steam from that blend in the water hit the rocks, it actually would penetrate your body. And you would also, at the end, oftentimes drink from that mixture in preparation for certain seasons, doing different things to your body. So the concept of water in all of its various forms is very special, and it reminds us that it is what ties us to every part of this planet, every part, every other creature. Everything needs water. So anyway, I don't know how much you know about the Nanticoke Lenape, but we are the people from the Chesapeake to the Delaware up to the Hudson. And the Lenape homeland, which is what Lenape Hoking means, it literally means the land of the Lenape. If you go all the way up to southwestern Connecticut and southeastern New York, all the way down all of New Jersey, which Sandra shared, the ancient name of this place is Shaikpe, the eastern part of Pennsylvania along the great rushing waters of the Lenape Iwihittok, which you call the Delaware, the Bay Area, Pawtucket, it's the Delaware Bay, and northern Delaware is the Lenape homeland. In the Chesapeake area, straight from the Chesapeake Bay across the Delmarva over to the Atlantic, is the Nanticoke homeland. And my people are the blend of those two tribes, those of us that remained, that stayed behind after the disbanding of some of our reservations, both here in New Jersey and down in the Delaware Bay, and living in little Indian towns, and for us in South Jersey, closely tied to the Quaker community, because protectorates were set up so that we would not be disturbed as the incursion from Europe continued and more people came, and many of our people were dying off. For every one that arrived, 9 of us died. 90% of our people died in the first few years of contact. That we were undisturbed in southern New Jersey, and you'll find oftentimes near Quaker meeting houses, somewhere around there is some story about a little tribal community. And the reason is because that was the relationship. This camp, the name of the camp, after Akanikan, which is one of our ancient chiefs, it's interesting, he's actually buried at the Burlington meeting. You can go see the approximate place. So he was buried near a tree, and there's a marker there. Now, we don't know whether the marker is right on his grave or not, because it happened quite a few years ago, back in the 1600s. But he's there, and he was a friend to the Quakers, so much so that when he died, he was buried in their graveyard. And he is one who commanded his successor to continue the peace, to continue a special relationship with those that were coming here that were of a good heart and a good spirit. The relationship continued with the famous Shackamaxon Treaty at what is today called Penn Treaty Park, where William Penn, the governor of Pennsylvania, and our chiefs, with our spokesperson at the time, a man named Tamanind, met, exchanged belts, and promised to live together in peace. And that treaty, which is over 350 years old now, is something that we continue to honor to this very day, especially with the Quakers that have continued in southern New Jersey. The Salem Indian Committee, the Indian Affairs Committee, is one that's near and dear in our hearts, and we have regular times of fellowship with them down at our tribal grounds. Not all of the Nanticoke and Lenape left. The fact that I'm sitting here is proof of that. Most of our people had migrated away by about 1740, not because they wanted to. I know that a lot of the history books say, oh, they were just so happy to leave. I don't know any people that are happy about losing their homeland. We were pressed away, and many of us wound up all the way out in Oklahoma, some way up in Canada, but there were those that stayed and continued to live in the land of their ancestors. And one of those communities is in South Jersey, the Nanticoke Lenni Lenape, which is directly tied to two other communities across the bay, the same family, same people, one, the Lenape Indian tribe in Cheswold, Delaware, just outside of Dover, and another, the Nanticoke Indian tribe in Sussex County in the little town of Millsboro, Delaware. All the same families, intermarried for generations, continued to govern ourselves in tribal churches for about a century and a half. Our community formed a constitutional government and began to govern itself separately from the church, although the church is still a tribal church, back in the 1970s. We continue a lot of the ancient traditions that have been passed down to us, kept quiet, kept to ourselves for many, many generations. And one of the things that's important to know is that whenever anybody says American Indians believe, odds are they don't know what they're talking about. And the reason is because you probably can't get 50 Quakers to all agree that they see things in the same way, you know, and there are hundreds of tribal nations and people in those nations, and so all of our beliefs are different. They differ by region, they differ sometimes tribe to tribe, and certainly even within a single tribe, you can have very different opinions. But if you talk about traditional spiritual values, beliefs, there are some that tie us together, generally speaking. And then when we get more specific, they tend to be regional, and they tend to be sometimes specific to a tribe, sometimes specific to a clan or a single family. Some of the things that are pretty much universal is that there was a strong connection to nature from ancient times. I don't know a single tribal community that did not have a strong connection to nature and view the earth, the land we live on, as being living and us having a responsibility to acknowledge it as such. The Lenape and the Nanticoke were monotheistic, always have been. That wasn't something that we learned from missionaries. We always were monotheistic. We have but one creator. And in English, his name translates, well, rather his title. He doesn't really have a name. We call him many things, but in English, the name is He Who Creates Us by Thought, which as a theologian, I think is a pretty powerful concept. He who creates, present tense, by thought. That we are here because he thinks about us. He is also the one to whom we pray. He who receives our prayer. He who is the giver of life. All of these titles were granted to the Creator because our ancient forebears understood that God was good, was the cause of all things, and that we were blessed and cared for by him. In ancient times, and even today, there was an understanding that there were many other forces out there, good and evil. And one of the angels, so to speak, we only had one God. Anytime you read anything about the Lenape and it talks about many gods, that somebody didn't know what they were talking about. But we did honor and respect other spirits that were given authority over certain things by the Creator. Just like I would honor my friend and she honored me in the introduction, just like I might give a gift of honor to some elder in our community, we would honor and respect the roles of these spiritual beings that were above us but below the Creator. And probably one of the most significant ones is the Missing. The Missing is an angel, so to speak, that was the guardian spirit of the forest creatures, maintained the balance between the needs of the forest creatures and the needs of the Lenape people. And the lesson of the Missing, the moral that it taught us and that we hold true today, is that you don't take more than you need at the moment, that everything must be held in balance, and that even the creatures are sacred. When our hunters kill an animal for food, don't believe in trophy hunting. We believe in hunting for food. We mourn the loss of the animal and pray over the animal and offer tobacco to the Creator over the animal for allowing us to take the animal's life. We actually apologize to the creature, knowing that its death is going to help sustain a family or the community. Every part of that animal has to be used in some way. To use a part of it and waste the rest would be to disrespect not only the animal, but the creator, and the Mising would have charge to bring some harm because you violated the principle, that balance. That balance is something that is part of all nature. We love shellfish. We love clams and living very close to the waters. And so one of the things that became very special is that after you finished, you know, eating your clams and eating from the shellfish, eating from the conch or the whelk, there would be these shells left over, and they were living too. So you had to use as much of them as you possibly could. And so wampum was made. And wampum are these shell beads. I'm wearing some of it today in bead form. And it was used not only for decorative purposes, but also it was made into beads. And those beads were woven into belts and necklaces and bracelets. The patterns that were woven into these belts would often record some event, some special thing. The Penn Treaty that I spoke of early was done through an exchange of wampum belts. And the belts were viewed as witnesses to the event because the shells came from a living creature. They are viewed not as dead, but as living. The belt held the story, the pattern in the belt told the story of the promise or the agreement and was the witness to that promise and agreement and was passed from one belt carrier to the next, whose responsibility it was to understand and be able to read that belt and to tell the story of the belt and to never allow the memory of that story to fall so that the promise could always be kept. Because the belt was living and the pattern reflected the promise, then the promise was alive. Many of our treaties were done under trees. And that's why there was the Shackamaxon Treaty Tree that one of the descendants is growing back at the Penn Treaty Park. We have two on our grounds down in South Jersey. A tree was where the Salem Oak was where another pact was made with Fenwick. And we have some folks that just gathered some of those acorns sitting right here. And we have hopes of having one of those descendants of that treaty tree on our grounds. But they were cut under trees because the trees were living and they lasted a long time. Those elms and those oaks could last for many, many years through many, many generations, and they were a witness to the promises that were made. The saying, your word is your bond, was very, very true and real for my people. If you said something, you were held to it. You know, saying something casually and thinking that it didn't mean anything was foreign to us. What you said had meaning. What you promised, you had to keep. No matter what came, if it was within your ability to keep the promise, you had to keep your word. Promise keeping was something that also was about your relationship with the Creator. That your words had to be true because they were not only spoken before other people, they were heard by the Creator. And to lie to another person was to lie to the Creator. So when you gave your word, you were making a sacred bond, a sacred promise, something that you had to perpetuate. Now, I know we're here dealing with issues of health. One of the issues of health, that spiritual health, wholeness for the land, for the person, understanding that the land is living, understanding that we have a relationship, an eternal tie to the land, understanding that we have a tie to the creatures of the land and to one another, and one of the ways that we maintain that relationship is by always speaking the truth and keeping our word. Are elements of that health, that's good medicine. They're the things that can cause you to live in a way where people can trust you. You don't have to remember which lie you told to who. Stress levels are down because you keep your word. If you have people around you who honor and respect the same things, you don't have to worry about watching them or keeping up with them or checking up with them because they keep their word too. Wouldn't it be wonderful if the world still worked that way? In regard to that connection, that sense of the earth's wellness and your wellness, there are things that we take from the earth, and we understand that the Creator has given us everything that we need to be healthy. Everything. And there are things that we are yet discovering that He has provided for us to be healthy. There are medicines that are in the ground, growing from the ground, under the ground, laying on the ground, in the waters. They're discovering medicines from fungus and algae and plants that we have always known have medicinal properties are actually incorporated into a lot of modern pharmaceuticals to this very day. And they come from the earth. The Creator has given us what we need. And so when we talk about medicine, we're not merely talking about the pill, you know, that may control your blood pressure or whatever from some pharmaceutical company. We're talking about anything that is good for your overall well-being. Anything that is good for your overall well-being is considered to be a medicine. So there are some medicines that you might think are a bit unusual. Going into that lodge and praying with your fellow worshipers, testifying to one another, singing together. Well, that's medicine. Why? Because it helps. It enhances your spiritual well-being. It helps to relieve stress. When we smudge, which is something that Sandra wanted me to talk a little bit about, over here we have a smudge pot and we have a smudge stick or smudge bundle, whichever you want to call it. That, I believe, looking at it, is cedar. Is that cedar? And we also use sage and sweet grass and tobacco and here sometimes even pine needles to burn and to smudge. Smudging was the process of actually causing the embers to send off smoke and then wafting the smoke over yourself, over others, over items, you know, within your home or whatever. And it was a form of blessing. It is still used today. In fact, whenever we open ceremony, we smudge, we prepare ourselves. And it is a way of cleansing. It's a symbol of spiritual cleansing. Now, the sage came to us from the Western tribes. It's hard to find around here. But we began using that more readily because of the sweet smell of the burning sage. The smudge, actually, we view the smoke as it rises to be representative, to be symbolic of our prayers going up to the Creator, which is why in olden days, even when American Indians converted to Christianity, they always wanted a window open in the church or some opening somewhere because smoke had to get out. There was this understanding that we wanted to see it go up in olden days. And so today, as we smudge, we use the same element, the same medicine, the cedar, sage, sweet grass, tobacco, sometimes pine, to send up that smoke, to bless ourselves with that smoke. It's essentially the equivalent of some of the high liturgical traditions in Christianity that use incense in the midst of worship services. Ours is used in the same similar way. The difference being that it comes directly from the plant material that the Creator has provided. We are offering back what He has given to us. The smudge pot that's on the table in the beautiful stand is a clay earthenware smudge pot with the smudge stick in it. This is a shell smudge pot with loose cedar in it. Both are quite appropriate to use. Sometimes it's just the smudge stick that's wafted around. I was actually doing a small ceremony in Philadelphia, and someone approached me and asked me about what I was burning, and I said, well, I was burning a cedar smudge stick. He said, it smelled so good. I said, yeah, I chose cedar because the police are all around, and was a sage smudge stick. I was burning sage, even though it wasn't strictly traditional for this area, because when you burn cedar, it smells a little like marijuana, and I wasn't interested in being on the news that evening. But the smudge pots can be made of different materials. Many individual families will use them just simply to bless their house or to bless things that they may even acquire, new furnishings. We still use drums. Traditional drums for us, actually the oldest ones, are water drums. I don't know if you've ever seen a water drum. They're a little drum that's made out of either a hollowed log or sometimes almost like a barrel. During the trading years, and you can see even today, they're made out of old kettles. But the ancient ones were made out of log, hollow area, and water was poured in it to various levels, and a wet skin was stretched down over it. And it had a very high-pitched tone. And based on how much water you have in it, it'll change the tone. We still use water drums today. More popularly, we have the hand drums that are used. And it's a skin stretched over a frame. And that's used to accompany our prayer songs. It's used to accompany our dances, sometimes just because we feel like singing. You also may have seen the large war drums. They are sometimes referred to as powwow drums. They came to us from the Western tribes within the past century or so. If you were walking during colonial times, you probably wouldn't see one that large here in the East. And that's where you have several drummers sitting around in a circle and beating the drum and singing together in unison. The sound of the drum represents the heartbeat of the community. Drums are sacred, and their music is soothing. And they are good medicine. When you came in, you heard flute music playing. Kind of stirs you to get into a meditative frame of mind. It relaxes you, because the Indian flute is good medicine. So not everything that we refer to as medicine comes in a little pill or a pill box. Sometimes you'll see tribal people having pouches this large or smaller. Sometimes they're only about this big and they're hanging and dangling from their neck. They're medicine bags or medicine pouches, and inside them is something that is special and sacred to the wearer. It's not always the same thing. It's whatever was good medicine for the person that was wearing that particular pouch. Something that reminded them of something special, something sacred, something of significance to them. Many will have a pinch of tobacco wrapped in a bit of cloth from some event where there was smudge or a fire or something, and they have put that memory in there. Sometimes it's a stone. Sometimes it's something completely different. So that is a constant source of good medicine, having a certain amount of spiritual significance to the wearer. If you were to keep a prayer journal and you wrote down every time that the Creator moved in a powerful way, got you through something, delivered you through something, enlightened you in a mighty way in the midst of some challenge or struggle, victory or whatever, or defeat, and you would go through that prayer journal every now and then, because our memories tend to be very feeble. Well, that's good medicine. And that's essentially what a prayer pouch is. That's what it is. It's that memory. It's what you attribute, that power that you attribute to something significant that you carry the memory around with you. My wife wears one often, and when she is asked, what does she have in it? And many, many times natives won't answer, but she is one who will. She says, my prayers are in it. Because when she prays, she holds that bag and may put a little something reminding her about that in the bag. That when she sees that prayer has been answered, it turns from a petition to a point of praise. So different people carry different things in their bags. The fan is used in several different ways. This happens to be a prayer fan, and prayer or ceremonial fan. There are also dance fans. Dance fans are dance fans because you dance with them. They're part of your dance regalia, and they are actually used in certain dances. This fan, prayer fans or ceremonial fans, they're set aside for spiritual use, for smudging, sometimes held by a spiritual leader during a talk. But the prayer fan and the dance fan have something in common. They're fans. So you can always use them just like this. Yeah. The feathers that we use are special to us. These feathers are from the turkey wing. Could you hold the tail feathers up? Those are turkey tail feathers. The turkey, wild turkey, was plentiful in this area, and you can still see some every now and then. And they're sacred to Lenape people. Matter of fact, one of our clans is the turkey clan down in Delaware. And the turkey feather was a particularly special feather. Matter of fact, you would see more turkey feathers on Lenape men than you would see eagle feathers in ancient times. This is a hawk feather. Raptors are special to us because of their swiftness, their hunting ability, their strength and courage. And so we also use eagle feathers. This hawk feather is a pointer, and sometimes actually can be used ceremonially. You can use a single feather also for smudging. But they are also special. Sometimes feathers are given as honor gifts. They're presented to an individual. A person that's wearing a feather, oftentimes, especially if it's an eagle feather, is supposed to have earned it. My chief will always proudly say, "I earned my feathers." Because sadly, these days, so many people get the big bonnets and they run around like it doesn't mean anything. But feathers are earned. They are granted because of something that you did that was worthy of honor, and they were presented to you. And it's a sacred trust, which is another reason why often you will find people protecting and guarding their feathers. If you're ever at a ceremony, a public event, and you see some feather adorning someone's hair, the last thing you want to do is to reach for it and touch it. That would be great disrespect. If it's a warrior, I cannot guarantee your safety, because there is an automatic reaction over those kinds of adornments. They're not just for fashion. They mean something. What we wear in ceremony, in dance, has significance. There are some articles and types of dress that are unique to a clan or even a family. My family, for example, has a ribbon work pattern that is unique to my family. For someone to go to an event and see some regalia and see a pattern or see some style of dress and say, "Ooh, that's neat. I'm going to put that on next Halloween." That is the height of disrespect, because that pattern or that piece of regalia may represent something incredibly sacred, incredibly significant. And just to treat it like it's simple fashion, there is no direct equivalent. It's not simple. It's not fashion. It's not a fashion statement. I could go on forever, but there's a whole lot of things up here I could talk about and different directions that we can go, but I want to give you a chance to have a dialogue with me. And what are your thoughts? What are your questions? I know you had a few that you thought might be a good idea to ask, so that we can fellowship more directly.
Thank you for listening to Clearly Quaker. We hope you have found this podcast thought-provoking. If you have questions or comments, or would like to learn more about South Jersey Quakers, reach us at salemquarter.net.